is to make the transition from history to science. And this week is the seventh in a series of eight connector lectures. And these connector lectures, these interval lectures, should themselves constitute an eightfold section, which would be two-thirds of a three-month period, which could be labeled religion. So that if you took the eight interval weeks together, it would be the first two-thirds of a ninth section called religion. And technically, the way that this cycle was envisioned, so that the cycle would not repeat in a mechanical rote way, there would be a month after the two-year period where the student population would finish up by extending the religion one more month, four more weeks, making a 12-week section also then for the ninth section. What I had in mind originally was that the first 8 weeks of the religion section would be presentations, but the final 4 weeks would be silent contemplative practice. So that in essence, when the two-year cycle was over, that would be all of the teaching. But before you could begin the cycle again, or before you really ended your experience, complication with the cycle, you would put yourself through four weekly meditation situations. You would take four Saturday mornings and set that time aside that you had invested in the course and meditate with it, so that the religion section would have eight lectures and four contemplative periods. That was the way I envisioned it. And when I looked over the structure last week, because we're getting ready to put this out as a book, which will come out next year, I realized that the work that I had in the seventh part was not going to function adequately in terms of all the structural load it had to bear. And so I've made a change, and I've finally found exactly the right work that will do the job. So we're going to use the Mundaka Upanishad today for our seventh interval, so that the eight intervals run like this. The first one, we would use the Dhammapada, the basic first Buddhist collection of sayings of the Buddha put into an order. The second one would be the Bhagavad Gita. The third one, the Cloud of Unknowing, that great 14th century mystical Midlands document from England. The fourth, Ibn Arabi's Journey to the Lord of Power, great Sufi classic. And the fifth, selections from the mystical poems of Rumi. And the sixth, Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus. And then the seventh, the Mundaka Upanishad. And the eighth, the Tao Te Ching. So that you would have, with these eight, a fairly complete example of world religious experience. Now, the only change that might occur here is I might put an American Indian text in place of either the Rumi or Ibn Arabi, although I'm very happy with the sequence as it runs now. The religion, the ninth section, should have the nature of disappearing, of being there in specifically the right way so that it ceases to be visible and yet still occurs. So this ninth section cannot be labeled as a section, but in all cases has to be designated as interval. Whatever time is devoted to it must be designated interval time, saying you have to count it, but it's counted like a zero is counted. You take it into consideration, but you don't add it as a definite quality, as a definite quantitative exactness. So that the eight sections of the educational program have a kind of a suspended quality because they're surrounded before and after by intervals which specifically tend to disappear, tend to not occur as qualitative, or rather quantitative things. So that each of the eight sections, instead of being linked together in a tinker toy fashion with nuts and bolts like an erector set, occur suspended. So that the perception would be, if someone were able to have a really deep analytical perception, what have I experienced? Your perception on a really deep level would record eight suspended related segments of time, segments of experience that are linked together by an invisible matrix. So that not only are each of the interval weeks there in a not there way, but they form a unity which extends indefinitely outwards. So that the religion section would really be colloquially what we call mystical experience. That is to say, you know that you have this experience, but you cannot define it. It's specifically not definable. That's the quality that should be there. So that this educational program, which incidentally I must tell you is a very powerful archetypal form, this eightfold path of discovery and self-learning is very powerful. And what I'm trying to do conscientiously is I'm trying to put qualities in it so that it cannot be perverted and used to enslave minds. The past history of mankind has shown that every advance, every tool, every technique that human beings have ever engendered for themselves have been abused. And the only technique that was never really able to be abused was the early analytical technique of the Buddha. And it was only later restatements of the technique that allowed for it to be abused, allowed for it in our time. Buddhism is largely an ethnocentric kind of a cultural pride. We're Sri Lankan Buddhists. Oh, we're Korean Buddhists. We've got gray robes. You've got red robes. One time, the Venerable Walpole Rahula, who's the senior monk in the world, on level par with the Dalai Lama, gave a lecture here in Los Angeles, and there were rows and rows and rows of people in all different colored robes, the Zen and the black, white Americans who prided themselves because they could read Sanskrit in nice yellow robes. There were saffron robes, brown robes, gray robes, red robes. I was the only person in the crowd that had no robe. And it was amazing because Venerable Rahula grinned. He looked like Barry Fitzgerald. You know the old actor? He grinned and he said, "In the West, the Buddha has no robe." I made a little gosho from the back of the room, and he was just grinning like Barry Fitzgerald having told a dirty joke. And I thought, that's right, man, that's exactly right. So even careful as Siddhartha was, it still was perverted. Man always tries to find a way. The only thing that I'm hoping to do is to forestall the abuse of this kind of powerful program long enough so that there'll be enough generations developed so that they'll be able to fight their way out of the abuses of it. Now, this program is extremely powerful. It does not appeal to just worldly common sense. It doesn't appeal just to a psychological response. It goes down to that symbolic level where archaic and primordial qualities are called forth. What I mean by this, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of having your head shaved. It's a primordial experience of denuding yourself of worldly ways to comport. The Old Testament mythic image that's already has no respect. That's why there are Avisi hells. The Old Testament biblical image of Samson losing his strength because his hair is cut. In every culture in the world, the hair is a symbol of vitality in this world, in this life, always. And to have it completely cut, to have it shaved, has an archetypal effect, a primordial effect. Having your hair done has an archetypal effect. It's on that level that this educational program works. Each section is meant to hierophantically evoke a primordial quality, and that when all eight of the qualities are together in sync, a ninth quality is evoked, which is that experience of the deep silence, of the lovability of reality. And in my mind's eye, I can see that the perversion sometime in the future, I don't think it'll happen in the next century at all. I think the 21st century is going to be okay. But I don't know about later on. There are problems. But the most likely point of perversion is to seal off and make an idea of the silence by that kind of inadvertent ignorance of truncating the experience and making it a powerful idea, which then can be translated into an ideology, which can then be expressed as a political party or religious movement. And it would be devastating, because the abuse of this kind of program would be a very hard prison for anyone to break out of. And so the kicker in the works, the kicker, what makes my fail-safe in this program, are that the intervals are there, those eight intervals, because I can see that the final 4 weeks, that final month of contemplation, of prayer, of meditation, of going out to have your vision, taking yourself out for a month retreat, or for 4 retreats each Saturday, that's the weak spot, because that would be left out. That's the most likely thing to be left out. So that these 8 intervals have to serve not only for their purpose of introducing major world religious experiences, as many different ones as possible, and to allow for each section to be suspended in between intervals, so that they're spacers, but they also have to indicate, each one of them has to accurately indicate that this is something that you should do, not just something to understand and say, aha, but after the aha, to stop yourself from talking more. After the sense of wonder comes, to turn off the idea flow and let the energy of quality occur in its clarity. I'm sorry to have to use that kind of word. It's perverted a lot in our time, but I mean clarity. The Vajrayana calls insight clear light. You see, but there's no light. There's no incandescent light. There's no source to the light. It's a sourceless light, and that's why it's clear. And one has to occur by that sourceless light. And however brilliant intelligence is, it's outclassed infinitely by that sourceless light. There's no comparison at all. It's like the difference between sketching some grapes and the grapes. It's a major difference. So I had to change this seventh interval. I was going to use the quantum electrodynamics, the little book by Richard Feynman, which is exceedingly excellent and well done and just a superb, almost a religious tour de force by someone who is not religious at all, but because they're perfectly not religious, it was religious anyway. Feynman was that kind of a way. The ultimate trickster, a physicist who was brilliantly a trickster, who was able to understand that indeed it is mysterious, exactly on the level of precise understanding. He was that way. But I've had to displace QED. Now, it's published by Princeton University Press, and in the Science and Spirit series at PRS, one of my lectures will be on QED, quantum electrodynamics, and Feynman's book. So I'll use it there. But today I'm going to use the Mundaka Upanishad, because that will come in. Now, the Mundaka Upanishad, mun in Sanskrit, means to shave. Not to shave your beard, but to shave your head. But it's metaphorical. It doesn't mean to take the hair off so much. It means to take off all that the hair connotates, all that you would understand by it. So Mundaka means to shave away ignorance, specifically the kind of worldly ignorance. Not by throwing it away, but by shaving it away, stroke by stroke, so that the way that you shave it away is through knowing it. Now you can see that this is the exact lead into science, because that's what science is for. Science is to not ignore the world or throw it away, but by understanding it exactly, seeing through it. It's exactly what has occurred, for instance, in nuclear physics. That by seeing that the atom is not the final structure, there's something inside. And not only that, there's something inside what was inside the atom. The protons, the neutrons, are made up of quarks, three in each, differing only because there's a different kind of a quark in a different proportion. The same kinds, but a different proportion. There's two of one kind and one of another kind in the proton, and the neutron is just the opposite, two of the other kind and one of the first kind. But that even the quarks themselves are held together by an odd kind of a glue, a kind of an energy quality, which for lack of a better word is called weak force. Not that it's weak, it's extremely strong. It's the glue of phenomenal reality. But it works on such infinitesimal levels that only infinitesimal amounts of it are needed. Now, in that fact is a trigger to an insight which becomes a very powerful idea. The trigger is this. Real power, the real power that holds everything together, works in such infinitesimal quantities that to us, on our level, on our proportionate level, it seems weak to the point of insignificant. So that the key to structure for man appears to be insignificant, even though it is enormously powerful. And it takes humility on man's part to recognize that this insignificant is exactly what is powerful. That's exactly where the power is, in what you thought was insignificant, not even worth paying attention to, that on the 19th decimal place, it didn't show up, but on the 20th, something showed. It's like the old religious admonition, until you are humble, there's no way that you can know. And the humbleness comes in realizing that on your scale, your size in this universe, you are midway. And the insignificant, down at the roots of phenomenal reality, also occurs at the very highest levels. The weak force is related to a strong force. And they work as a continuum. And that somehow, on the largest cosmic level, what holds the universe together, what holds the galactic clusters together, is exactly that which holds the quarks together. So that if one were able to visualize the pulse of reality, there would be like a fountain starting from the very small, insignificantly, coming through where we are and going out and coming back to the very inner part of every quark cluster. So that there is this kind of pulsating fountain quality to phenomenal reality. That phenomenal reality is a pulse in an ecology of the insignificant manifesting for just a moment as matter and of disappearing into the vastness to reappear in the insignificant. So that all early sophisticated languages, the word for nature was a process. It wasn't a dead noun, a labeling noun, but was a word that indicated process, or a word that had a gerund kind of quality. The Greek word for nature was physis, which literally meant becoming. The early Hebrew word, which begins the Old Testament, bereshith, does not mean in the beginning, but it means in a gerund kind of way, beginning, da-da, da-da, da-da. So that all early intelligent languages, the word for nature was that this is a very mysterious reality which is alive and dynamic, and that we occur as a node at some strategic point in the ecology of this dynamic. And that's what we are. We're not a pebble in the works, but we're like a curve, an odd kind of a twist in a sine wave of energy. And that in our worldly ignorance, if we could experience that on the deepest level, we would experience that as a knot of energy. And the key to wisdom, as opposed to ignorance, is to see that that knot of energy is a bow, not a knot, and that if you just pull on it, it'll come free, and you will be free, and you will flow again in that dynamic ecology and be real. That was the classic understanding. That is exactly the way. The Mundaka Upanishad exactly delivers this teaching by saying you can't get down to that knot in you until you shave off the world by not ignoring it or circumventing it in any clever way, but by knowing it and knowing it, seeing through it. That by knowing it, vidya, one not only sees it, but one sees it in such a way that it becomes transparent. And you go to the next level. And when you see that, it becomes transparent. You go on. It's not just vidya, but it's Brahma vidya. It's seeing with God's eye. Science is just this. Science is shaving off the levels of the world by seeing it exactly for what it is, so that the occurrence of it is no longer what's noticeable, but the structure. And when one sees the structure, one sees through the phenomenon to the numinous structural quality and goes deeper or goes higher, either way. The Mundaka Upanishad then teaches us Brahma Vidya, how to see, and the ultimate object, the ultimate phenomenal object that science would see is the self, and one would see the self as that knot of energy, but by also applying Brahma Vidya to the self, one sees that, oh, it is not a knot, it is a bow. If I just tug it in the most infinitesimal, slight way, it comes free, it comes loose. It will not come loose if I tug it with more energy. It will occur as a knot if I struggle with it. And the more I struggle with it, the more knot-like it seems to become. So the key is to use the insignificant energy almost approaching. It's like a calculus asymptotic curve, approaching the effortlessness. It's not quite exactly effortless, but it seems effortless. But there is an inscrutable kind of a tug, and that loosens that knot. And the Mundaka Upanishad teaches the way in which we can approach ourselves to have this exact occurrence. And that the way, on the way, what we have done is the scientific investigation of the universe. In every detail, every single detail. And the implication here is that though there is a vast, unimaginable almost, number of details in the universe, it is still finite. Enormous though it is in fact technically finite, so that one can finally know it all. But that the final thing that one could know is to know that there is an unknowable, which also does occur, which is not any of the details, but was the glue holding all of the details together in their finiteness, and that infinite glue also occurs, also is real. And by opening to that, one is free. So here's the Mundaka Upanishad. And I'm going to use four different translations of it, mainly the one by Radhakrishna in this large book, The Principal Upanishads. Now, I did this at the Philosophic Research Society, and we have cassettes. I did the whole 13 Principal Upanishads, and you can get tapes of those if you want. And the Mundaka Upanishad tape is available. This will be somewhat different. In the Mundaka Upanishad, when you look at the document, when you look at it as a phenomenal text, and you count, you see that there are three chapters. Each of the three chapters has two parts. So that if you counted the whole, there would be six parts, a six-part structure, a hexagram. But within that three-chapter, six-part total pattern, if one counts the verses, one comes up with the fact that there are 64 different verses. So by looking at it as a whole, one comes up with a hexagram structure. By looking at it in its detail, one sees that there is a 64-verse cycle. And you can see that this correlates to a hexagram in the I Ching and the 64 hexagrams as a whole. It's an indication. It's an indication, I say, emphasizing, indication of its archetypal nature. Those kinds of numerical proportions, those grand ratios, are extremely important. Notice, what is 8 times 8? What is 8 doubled? 8 squared. Voila. That's how you can see. There's, in the pattern of experience, there's an exponential of 8 that occurs, which jibes with the proliferation of a six-part structure occurring also. So that the relation of 6 to 8 or 3 to 4 is primordial relationship. Why is it primordial? It's primordial because at the expressive node of the first complete cycle of each, they come into sync. And of course, I guess you can understand that 8 can also be written of 2q, 2 to the 3rd. So you have, this is very Pythagorean, I realize, and maybe stretching a little bit, but what you need to get out of this is the indication that there are ways to demonstrate proof to yourself, which are classic and can always be brought into play. It's better not to start out with those. It's better just to start out with whatever you can do. But when you get to a certain level of comprehension, when you get to making form work, then you have to turn on the caliper recognition and say, what have I got to? And count. It's just like the primordial thing of getting down to the fingers. Well, how many fingers do I have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's something about 5. There's something about the quintessence of the hand in the thumb. You see, it's like the structure on a symbolic level is so truthful, it cannot lie. And when your insight gets to that refinement to be able to see exactly what is there, you see exactly, that's what it is. So the Mundaka Upanishad has 64 verses in a six-part structure. And again, it means, mund means to shave. Only someone who has given up everything can obtain the highest knowledge, says Radhakrishnan. What is the final thing that one gives up? One finally gives up coveting, the struggle with the not. And by not any longer struggling with it, that's the tug that loosens what seemed to be a knot, which is really a bow, into openness. By not struggling is the tug. It's esoteric. If you go into a very deep samadhi and you stop your proliferation of thinking and bring it to one pointedness, ekagrata, so that you can hold just a single thought, one's immanent presence, one's kinesthetic balance, and just hold that. You can even vanish that. And without making any kind of attempt whatsoever, the world still occurs. And you occur again without any intentionality whatsoever on your part. This is the same kind of tug that the stopping of struggling with the self, that in itself, the stopping of the struggle is the tug that loosens it and creates enlightenment, creates the unblocking, so that you occur with the grand flow of this fountain of the cosmos. And can not only can you go anywhere, but you are anywhere that you wish to be. Anywhere. The beginning of the Mundaka Upanishad, the chapters, the sections are called khandas, so there would be six khandas altogether. It reads this way: Brahma arose as first among the gods. That is to say, what occurs first without any intention, without any plan, that is God. That is to say, there is a causeless occurrence that even though there is no cause, it still occurs, still happens. That's what God is. There is no cause at all. And one can say that it's nothingness. But what happens is not creatio ex nihilo, not creation out of nothingness, but that the nothingness itself had a dynamic. And the first move, the first movement, first dynamic, that's God, the pure dynamic. So Brahma arose as the first among gods, the maker of the universe. How does he make the universe? By durational occurrence. Just durational occurrence. It's the stirring of the pot, and there's no pot, and there's no paddle, but the stirring occurs. Just that, Barishith. It's not mystical, it's exact. You have to understand the Upanishads are delivered from deep self masters who are just, they're not talking from their mind at all or their larynx, they're just talking from deep self. In Sanskrit it reads, Brahma Divinam. Prathnama, Sambadvuba, Visvaya Karta, Bhuvanayasa Gupta. Brahma arose as the first among gods and maker of universe, protector of the world. How is he a protector of the world? Because it's the ultimate amulet, motion pure and simple. Whatever it is made of permutations of the motion and are not things in motion, but are nodes of the motion itself. So that things are not there as things, but they're there as nodes in a tension in motion. That's how they're there. That's how we are here. In just this way. He taught, projecting a sense of person now. The Sanskrit reads, Sa Brahma Vidyam, Sarva Vidya. He taught the knowledge of Brahma. He taught the knowledge of himself, how does he teach the knowledge of himself? By being what he is. Not by saying anything about himself, but by being what he is, and one being able to see what he is in terms of exactly what he is, that's knowledge, that's vidya. The foundation of all knowledge, he taught this to Artharvan, his eldest son. Artharvan, his eldest son. That knowledge of Brahman, which Brahma taught to Artharvan, and Artharvan in olden times told Angiras. Now, Angiras was a sage, a whole family of sages, the Angirasi. But Angiras is always styled as archetypal sage from Rig Veda times. Mundaka Upanishad's about 650 BC, about contemporaneous with Isaiah. But Rig Veda is from about 1,000 years before. So the original Angiras, that seer, sage, poet of the Rig Veda, was from ancient archaic times. But those who were in that tradition were all sons of Angiras and also took that name. It means that anyone in that tradition, in that lineage, was able to see the eldest son of God in themselves. The whole phenomenon of Jesus is just archetypal. You can see it doesn't mean that it's just uniquely singular. It's very, very archetypal. One sees through one seer-like sage quality in the purity of your language. One sees the eldest son of God as that level, and through that you hear directly what God said to him and thus to you. So the Mundaka Upanishad, the sage who is delivering this, says, in effect, I'm not telling you anything from me. This is exactly what God said to his eldest son, that said to the sage Angiras, that you can hear yourself if you go in. This is what it is. He in turn, Angiras, taught it to Satyavaha, son of Bharadvaja, and the son of Bharadvaja to Angiras, both the higher and the lower knowledge. And for the first time, when you get into the sequence of how did this declension of pristine knowledge come down, how does it come down to us? By the time one goes through that process of a declension, notice that it has split into a higher and lower knowledge. All of a sudden, at the end of the second verse, is the first time it ends with Bharadvaho Nirgirasi Paravarana, both the higher and the lower knowledge. Paravaram, both the higher and the lower knowledge. That is to say, there is a knowledge which is descended from the greater to the lower. The act of making a declension, of making a recession of the knowledge, in itself is generated a higher and a lower. The declension itself, in its moving point to you, is a lower knowledge by the time it gets to you. But its origin is a higher knowledge. So it's a higher and lower, not in a bifurcation, which are contemporaneous, but a bifurcation in terms of original and now image. So it's a lower knowledge in an imitative sense, in an imaginative sense, in an image sense, because it has gone through a passed-on declension. This lower aspect is only apparent, because if one sees the vidya in yourself in the right way, you can see that the way it was passed to you is through clear selves. No one interfered with it. And it came to you exactly in the higher form. It only appeared to you temporarily that it was in a lower form, in an imitation, because you were not ready to see it in its fullness yet. When you were able to shave off your ignorance, you could see then that you had been past the original knowledge. This is God Himself. It's no third hand or fourth hand or even second hand. That the lineage of the sages was such that each was a complete open threshold through which the sight comes directly to you. And even though they're there, they didn't interfere at all with it. Notice the insight that comes here. The only way that you could teach this to someone else is for you to clear your space, for you to become an open threshold. And only then can you teach it to someone else. So that there's always this kind of equality. Should we change our cassettes?